See, history is drawing, coming to a halt, drawing to a close. What the scripture calls this world and the things of this world have now run their course and fulfilled their purpose. God has given men their agency and let the world run its course. Now the fruit is ripe, the cup is full, and he tells us now in this chapter, as he does in so many others, nothing can be gained from letting it run any further. And above all, of course, the number is fulfilled, coming here. And he's declared it his set purpose to bring an abrupt end to this dismal act. This is the wind that goes on. First, notice, this is the voice of Jesus Christ. And the second verse, for the gathering of his people. Who are his people? Those who will hearken, those who will humble themselves, and those who will come upon him, call upon him in mighty prayer. Who they are. Being forgiven, they're still in constant danger of gravitating toward the world. We're not by any means out of the world yet. Notice that. Remember, sin no more, lest the perils, lest peril shall come upon you. He's talking to the church, those who have been redeemed out of the world, but we're still exposed to it as long as we're in the flesh. As long as we're in the tabernacle of the flesh, we're subject not only to temptation, but we're subject to backsliding. Sliding. Remember, if the angels who kept not their first estate, don't congratulate yourself that we're safe, because even the angels kept not their first estate. Well, but he makes it clear now. He goes right, it's the usual here, again. They're chosen out of the world, and it's a joyful mission as they're spreading the word. Because all this idea of separation, being removed, coming out, totally different order of things. And the Lord is in their midst, going on the fifth birth, lift up your hearts and go back, or I am in your midst. What a totally different society this is going to be. And as such, he is the go-between, between us and the Father. He is the advocate with the Father, and it is his good will to give you the kingdom. Well, this is setting up something very special, very extra. Notice this time. This is still in 1830. And then is the promise of the gift. Anything you ask, you'll have. You'll be given. But, notice before, safety clauses here, there, so that you won't ask for the wrong things. Whatsoever you ask under three conditions, in faith, united in prayer, according to my command, you shall receive. We don't want to get anything that would do us damage. It would be very dangerous. We're not wise enough to ask the right thing. The Lord says, what you ask, according to my will, you will receive. So everything is being set up, remember, but it's just the first step here. What a foundation is being laid. And what is their work to be? The gathering of the elect. Always is gathering up. Elect means to choose, to select. Elegra means to, literally to pick out. Legra means harvest, to pick up. And elegra means to pick out of a group of others. The church of the Kyriake, the church. Some say the word is derived, the word church is derived from Kohelet, among the Jews, which means called out. Those whose names are called out of a larger group, always being called out. Again, notice all these separation, division, moving in opposite directions and so forth. So he says, it's the gathering of elect, and who are those? Who hear and receive. There's no prejudice here, there's no special privilege or anything like that. As the Lord said to Philip, well, who shall we preach the gospel to if we're not to, he says, if we're not to preach, to cast the pearls before the swine or the food of the children to the dogs and so forth, to anyone who asks. If they ask, give it to them. If they knock, it shall be opened. If they seek, they shall find. And that's the test. No one's going to hold it back from you for a minute if you ask. And that's very safe, see. There's a safety clause there. No one is going to, who doesn't ask for sincerity, no one's going to get it who doesn't ask for it, so we're not giving any secrets away. They don't interest anybody else at all. This whole thing is going on, you see, unbeknownst to the world. It's the best kept secret in the world. Nobody ever finds out about it because of the measure of faith and belief you have to have to enter into the operation at all. perfectly safe from giving anything away. It's and it's, so it's a gathering out. And here is the geographical field. In the 8th verse, it tells us. We've got to go faster because we're getting behind it, so we're moving right along here. Unto one place on the face of this land. That was the first move. There had to be one center. In fact, in non-existence here, there's only been existence six months, no less than that. 4 months. There were very few people. And they had to be united, had to be organized, and they all also had to come together in one place to get any kind of a foundation going at all. This is not set forth, notice, as a general principle there. These are special instructions for getting things started here. To one place on the face of this land, he tells us why. See, that's only preparatory, most next thing. To prepare for the day, then here comes the separation. This is why it's going to be wise to move out, he says. The decree of God forth to one place upon the face of this land to prepare their hearts and be prepared, to be prepared mentally and physically in every way, to be prepared especially for the, for what? The day when tribulation and desolation are sent forth upon the wicked. We're going to hear a lot about that in this 29th section. This 29th section is very powerful. And then he goes on in the next verse to say, the day is soon at hand and the earth is ripe. Notice he used that expression. When fruit is ripe, there's no point for letting it go any longer. It's time to pick it. If it goes on any further, it'll just be rotting. We've reached a point where there's nothing more to be expected from the processes of this world after its long history, the phase we know about. We know very little about it, actually. But we know right now it's coming to the end of a phase in which there's great confusion and very little hope anywhere. Nobody expects things are going to be better, but how can they possibly go on getting worse much longer, as far as that goes? Well, this talks about this back here. Always this different. All of this is in a sense of preparation. Notice there's nothing being rushed here. It's not gathered together. And this is just to prepare your minds for things that are going to come. And the desolation is going to be set forth on the wicked. Now, he talks about burning more than once in this section here. But he says, the day is soon at hand, it's not now, the day is soon at hand when the earth is ripe. It is soon. It's very soon now, you can be sure of that. And what's going to happen? The proud and the wicked shall be burnt up as stubble. The cleansing of the earth by fire. This isn't the final instruction will be like that. But the cleansing by fire and the burnt up by stubble. Noted before in the Book of Mormon, that verse, again and again, the great overburn. There's going to be a cleansing, there's going to be a fire of some sort. It refers to it so often, you can't deny there must be some specific type of thing. There's going to be a special kind of fire. Always remember, as stubble. Remember, the stubble is what is left in the field. It being very dry, it is utterly wiped out, utterly burned. And that, unfortunately, the next verse, I'm going to say nothing unfortunate here, it's all the will of the Lord. He says that's unconditionally proclaimed in the 10th verse. The hour is nigh, and that which was spoken of in my apostles must be fulfilled. For as they spoke, so shall it come to pass. It is not to be avoided. Certain things are going to happen. Well, you say, oh yes, people repent, they can change it all, yes, they repent. But it's been prophesied what they will. Remember, the Lord knows the hearts and minds of men. When you're on a collision course, anyone viewing from outside can see what's going to happen. The collision is going to take place, and you can say, it's inevitable, unless something else happens. But certain things, in this case, he says it's going to happen. There are these things going to happen. These punishments. Now, there would not be such. They could be stopped if everybody was to repent and all this sort of thing. But that is the big if. Nowhere. This is why the church is being gathered out, because he says you can expect these things with total confidence. Next, he tells us that the millennium is near at hand, and it's to be a real event. I will reveal myself from heaven in power and great glory with all the hosts thereof, and dwell with the righteous men on earth 1,000 years, that's the millennium. and the wicked shall not stand. So he's coming, and it's going to be a real event. But what do we have to do before we get over the hump? He goes on, stands the next one. The original 12 apostles will judge the righteous of Israel in glory. They're sitting as judges, but they judge the righteous. It's an interesting thing. They don't have to worry anymore. How about judging everybody else? How about judging the sins of men? The Holy One of Israel is the keeper of the gate. He employs no service. It's marvelous for its meaning. He is the one who will judge. We don't have to worry about anyone else not getting an unfair judgment or having to appeal to a higher court. He employs no servant. He is the keeper of the gate, the Holy One of Israel. What marvelous consolation for all of us. You're going to get a fair trial. It's going to be fair. Don't worry about that. And then it talks about the trumpet. The dead which died in me that's going to blow here. This long 12th verse gives a description of the New Jerusalem and how it ties up with the old. The millennium is more closely tied, see, with the ministrations of the Lord on earth. When he actually was here, the dispensation of the meridian of time, peak of everything, this is what's going to come in the millennium again. And then talks about coming in a pillar of fire, being clothed with robes of righteousness, with crowns upon their head, even as I am, to be judged the whole house of Israel, even as many as have loved me and kept my commandments, and none else. They will judge just the righteous, those who have loved him and kept his commandments, and no one else. There's the real judgment that will be left to him. For the trump shall sound both long and loud, even as upon Mount Zion, and the earth shall quake, and they shall come forth, even the dead which came. Now, this is a description of events. A situation, incidentally, it sounds fantastic. Well, it's already been realized on earth in the 19th chapter, 35, after the great, there was a great destruction there, and the Lord came from heaven, came in glory, the saints were clothed in glory, the apostles, their glory shone upon him, and all those sections from chapter 10 right through chapter 23 in 3rd Nephi describes an event that actually took place on earth, very much like this. We think, well, this is fantastic. This is going way out, this sort of thing. Well, of course it is. But I think we have enough space built and fantastic things now. Confrontations of the third kind and Star Wars and things like that. Now we're getting the idea of untold worlds of things beyond which could still be real. See, this sort of thing. Well, it's talking about it here. And of course, this is the source of all that stuff that they build up. You know, the man who's doing this galactic nonsense. He is a member of the church. He's talked here this week. And I guess he's guilty of unconscious plagiarism. But Brigham Young said a lot about that. Some very interesting things. Every time, he says, Joseph Smith presented the world with a lot of original and wonderful ideas. But instantly, the first thing that happened was the Satan counterattack with counterfeit, the same sort of thing. Now, until the story of the angel and the one that came and so forth, nobody believed the Christian world was absolutely against the idea that men could possibly communicate with other worlds of spirits. Then all of a sudden, in the 1840s, came this rash of spiritualism. Mesmerism, Daniel Holm, the spiritists, and Lise Upton, Madame Blavatsky, and so forth, everybody was claiming that. The doctrine that drove more people from the church than any other, said Brigham Young, was the doctrine of pre-existence. Now, people take that in its course. The doctrine that there were life on other worlds was one of the things that was held as one of the worst blasphemies and follies of Joseph Smith. Now, everybody shrugged their shoulders and says, of course there is. But I remember when I was in school, and when they taught astronomy not so long ago, they'd order you out of the room if you even suggested life on other worlds, because that meant you were a nut, you were way out, and you were utterly irresponsible, didn't have any concept of scientific judgment at all. The idea that there should be life, in other words, utterly absurd. Well, and so we come along and they try to defuse these ideas by saying, sure, we knew it all along. And so it goes right down the line. So these things here we're getting, these images we get, say, from this 29th of the glories to come and so forth, have now been preempted by Hollywood. And this sort of thing, this happened all along. The idea of the church in the wilderness, driving out the saints and so forth. Everybody starts copying that, as I say. The Pope today talks about Israel as the church in the wilderness and so forth. But let's move on here. But our concern, now the 14th verse, our concern is what we must face before that heavy time. That we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. He's looking forward to that. The reason he talks about that here is some of the saints, some of the brethren had asked about it. They wanted to know more specifically. That's what this chapter is mostly about. He says, I'm telling you in your language because you asked me. I'm giving you as much as you're allowed to hear right now. That's why he brought this in here, because they were asking about it. But now he says, what you're concerned with is what's going to happen in the meantime. And before that happy event, look at the things that would happen. Behold, I say unto you, before this great day shall come, the 49th section, you're going to get another very important statement on that. Now we get some interesting phenomena. The sun darkened and the moon turned to blood. Is that moon literally blood? What kind of blood? Type A, type B, type O? Or no, not that. When the sun is darkened, then smog, the pollution of the atmosphere has that same effect. The sun certainly is darkened, and the moon takes its blood red, as it does during a lunar eclipse, takes a blood red complexion, and the sun is darkened. That's from our point of view, remember. As seen from the earth out, the sun is darkened, because there's obscuring stuff there. It's not that the sun itself actually turns dark, and the same as the moon doesn't turn anything, but when the sun is dark and the moon is extremely dark and it gets this deep coppery red and sometimes blood red, and again the stars falling from heaven, well, we know stars, being most of them larger than the sun, aren't all going to fall onto the earth. But this is meteorites. Notice it's seen from our point of view. This is the normal language used by the human race at all times. When you see a meteorite, you call it a falling star. A star, literally, an astere, a star, is any celestial body. The sun is a star, the star of day. There is a famous poem by Goethe, Thou Star of the Sleepless, talking about the moon as a star. You get a vivid picture here. Smog or something, the air becomes thick, the moon turns blood red, the sun is darkened, and meteoric activity. This is Einstein month, and we are being made familiar with a lot of interesting celestial phenomena. The main thing from the last 2 weeks has been the astonishing discovery of how little we know about things we thought we knew a lot about. First was about the sun. They're announcing now that the sun, its probable source of energy, its origin, its composition, they had pretty well made up their minds about what that was. During the years, the big solar observatory up there in Mongolia, so Adam's famous work on the sun. Nothing. All wrong. We have no idea where the energy of the sun comes from, the process by which it's burned, etc., etc. They're telling us now in the articles that we've got to start all over again guessing about the sun. As far as Jupiter's concerned, it's over the biggest, most spectacular planet, easy to see, the first one really noted, studied by Galileo. He had a good telescope and so forth, and he discovered the moons and named them and so forth. The great red spot wasn't there in Galileo's day. You know that great red spot we see the spectacular pictures of in the newspaper? That didn't exist before the 17th century. Toward the end of the 17th century, all of a sudden, one night, that great red spot appeared. It's been there ever since. Nobody knows what it is. Now we discover it's an area of tremendous turbulence, the center of which apparently is perfectly stable, and it just goes on being the great red spot. But the point is, these pictures, as you may have read, are the headlines in the newspaper. The astronomers just don't know what to make of it. And then these moons of Jupiter, they're so different. One seems to be made of solid ice and nothing else, a vast thing. Another one, strange as Callisto and Io, but the surface looks like nothing else. Brilliantly variegated colors on the surface. It has a few craters, but not many, but very high plateaus somewhere. Evidence everywhere of lots of water having been there. It's larger than our moon, but the other one is larger than the planet Mercury. And it's incredibly cold, so cold that it just keeps throwing snow out all the time into space, apparently. Well, all these things are new. They're just from a couple of weeks we've learned this. So when it starts describing phenomena like this, notice it talks about the miseries of war, which are part of the picture. There shall be weeping and wailing among the hosts of men, hosts, regular biblical language, Tzavaot, the hosts meaning the armed hosts, the armies, and as the multitudes, as far as that goes, there'll be general misery on the earth, of which there's a great deal today. We just noted today that right now over a quarter of the earth's population are engaged in hot wars. They're in real war over, and yet this is a time of peace. And the rest of the world isn't doing so well, but they're all in cold war. And notice then more phenomena. A great hailstorm to destroy the crops of the earth. Now this, of course, suggests violent atmospheric disturbances, the Velikovsky type and so forth. And again, interesting discoveries have been made of extremely high electrical charges on the earth and interchanges between planets and all this sort of thing. Well, the ultimate in atmospheric disturbances, we know the standard storm is a cumulonimbus, which is always a lightning and always produces hail. Hail is produced, by moisture that first falls, and then the violent updrafts of air carry it up again. Another layer freezes on it, down it comes again, it goes up again, up and down in this violent cumulonimbus cloud. We know in times historically the earth has passed through some phases in which this happened. And finally comes down as hail, tremendous hail. But it is conceivable, you see, that the atmosphere of the earth should become so violent. Again, here's another thing. If you've been following me, I used to be a weather forecaster, for a short time. I was not responsible for that accident on Bear Mountain. I was off duty at the time that happened. But I was transferred because I had because I knew some Arabic, and they needed somebody desperately in Washington for that. That's a long story. You won't go into it. No, it's not a long story. But anyway, if you've been following the weather forecast during this interesting winter of ours, they've been right about a fifth of the time, and it was accidental when they got it right as far as that came. We still don't know anything about these things. These last rains that came, when they would confidently say, "Well, have beautiful weather tomorrow," it rained all day the next day. And then they say, "Well, it's going to get warmer," and then there'd be a terrific cold spell. And Eubanks, yes, I think Harvey Eubanks, man. Poor Mark Eubanks, he quite frankly said, "I just don't know what happened. I can't understand what it was." But it is funny. We didn't have, in my day when I was a weatherman, we didn't have the ducks in the Army. And actually, we didn't have satellite pictures and things like that. We could see what was happening. We had to get it all in the teletype and then put it together and draw your Rossby diagrams and figure everything out what would happen. And then it either happened rain or it didn't rain. There was nothing you could do about it as far as that went. But this happens. What about a great world hailstorm, a time of violent atmospheric disturbance throughout the earth, when for some reason or other, because of differentials in air temperatures at various levels, which could very well happen, the misbehavior of the sun. This year already, there came a solar protuberance in a direction and with a force and violence that had never been dreamed of before. It stopped all radio communication for a couple of days. It was rather hushed up. But we'd seen You could see a few little ones during the last solar eclipse, but we knew that they had these solar breakouts and so forth, and these tremendous explosions. But this one was 100 times bigger than any that had ever been seen before. Nobody ever thought anything like that could happen to the sun. And it radically changed certain views about the sun. Well, things like that happen, and we don't know what's going to happen. And this talks about the big hailstorm, and I think there's going to be that big hailstorm.
What about the Halley's Comet supposed to be coming particularly close to the Earth in 1986?
Remember that big thing 2 years ago, wasn't it, about the big comet we were expecting was going to be the supercomet? It's completely fizzled, nothing happened. We don't know whether Hadron is broken up or not. No, they just keep coming here. But now we're discovering all sorts of things. All this space junk that's going around. Again, here we are. Since we last met, we now know that there's a ring of debris, of rocks around Jupiter. We knew there was a ring around Saturn. Then all of a sudden they discovered one around Uranus, which was quite sensational. But this week, one around Jupiter. They say, well, it probably came during the process that the planet was being made. But here is a ring several miles thick, consisting of millions and millions of big rocks going around and around in a ring. It wasn't visible to me from the Earth, the way Saturn's is. But a thing like that, a phenomenon, that's the sort of thing no one had ever dreamed of. And would say, well, maybe there's a ring of stones circling Jupiter too, ha 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 ha. Well, there are 13 moons, but what a collection of them. Some of them are vast, I mean, some bigger than the planet Mercury. And some, they say, bigger than our moon, but totally different. No two of them look alike. They're like totally different worlds. One covered with iron and sulfur and all sorts of stuff like that. And the other seems to be covered with active volcanoes. They think they can see the lights and flames and all this sort of thing. Well, and there's some Venus, too. Every day we find out things about Venus. Now it seems that it's covered with. Maybe that has to do something with the high temperature and so forth. Covered with active volcanoes. You can see the flickering now. Oh boy. Some worlds we live in, eh? The point is, we don't know very much about it. It's possible some people know about telecosmic theories about the Earth coming here to Venus and to Mars and so forth, the tremendous catastrophes that happened on those occasions. Well, that may not be the cause for the explanation of the catastrophe. There's no doubt about it.
The catastrophe did occur because we have eyewitness accounts, not a few of those things happened.
Well, and then it talks about pleasant things like flies and maggots next, and then something that looks a good deal like radiation sickness in the 19th verse here to cheer us up. Their tongues shall be stayed, they shall not utter against me, their flesh shall fall from their bones and their eyes from their sockets.
We're getting something in the nature, something quite pernicious going on here, isn't it?
And this utter helplessness and disintegration, utter helplessness, this is the thing we've never thought of before. We say, well, with modern science, we can keep up with these things. Well, look at the reports that have been made on the radiation. This week about the cloud that hung over Los Angeles for 4 days and gave it 700 times the normal dose of radiation. This was just announced 3 days ago. They thought all their radiation from the cloud was going over Utah was taken care of. We absorbed it for them. This they decided to send out over the Pacific, see what had happened. It moved south, hung over the Pacific, and then turned back again and was trapped over Los Angeles in an high inversion, and has to stay there for 4 days doing its stuff. But all this stuff has got everybody sort of rather helpless, everybody hushing everybody else up and so forth. And then comes the return of the beasts, another surprise. It doesn't take long getting half a chance to come back, but to take over. And then the great and abominable. This is very interesting here. The great and abominable, remember, are told here, identifying it is interesting. The great and abominable church, the horn of all the earth, shall be cast down, not into the devouring fire, but by devouring fire. Again, there's reference to the fire. Be cast down by fire. There's going to be some destruction there. As spoken by the mouth of Ezekiel. Well, where does Ezekiel talk about the great and abominable church? Well, the 22nd chapter of Ezekiel says the great and abominable, or whoever, fight against Israel, as it says in the Book of Mormon. whoever finds, and in Ezekiel 22nd chapter, it's described as the negation of Israel. When Israel goes bad, when Israel turns its training, its teachings, its covenants, and all the rest to evil purposes, that is the great abominable. So when Ezekiel talks about it, it's not the Roman Catholic Church that's all who fight against Israel, we're told in the book of Mormon, are the great and abominable. I've never identified that. It seems obvious. You know. They might have the honor of being included sometime, but by no means always. It's the negation of Israel here that's described in Ezekiel 22. You don't have to belong to a particular church to partake of, or a party, to partake of its sin, to be guilty of things that are done without being a member, a registered member. Well, that matter, we said before, you can break all the Ten Commandments without being a communist. Read the 19th verse again here. The greatest of these, in fact. The hour is nigh at hand, when the earth is ripe. Now, and all the proud and they that do wickedly shall be as stubble, and will burn them up. Now, it talks a lot about that sort, but it never tells who the wicked are. It never locates them. It doesn't need to. And it talks a great deal about sin that will be punished without ever defining sin. It doesn't need to. We're told what will. The proud and they that do wickedly. Who are they that do wickedly? Your party or my party? Well, don't be silly. We know what the wicked are, as Alma says, 5 and 18. We know with a perfect knowledge who is doing wickedly and who isn't, when it applies to yourself. It's only our own wickedness that we can have a perfect awareness of. You don't have a perfect awareness of somebody else's wickedness. What looks as wickedness to you may be naive and innocent behavior, tells us later in this chapter. As far as that is concerned, things that would be wicked if we did them, the children could do and get away with them, because they're still not accountable. But you're perfectly aware of a wickedness where? Do I know? Do you know how wicked I am? You'd be surprised. Maybe you think I'm very wicked for some things where I might not. That might not be wicked at all. On the other hand, other things I'm getting away with. You'd be surprised. In other words, you don't know about another person, but you do know about your own with a perfect understanding. So it never bothers to define wickedness. It goes down into specifics. It's true of this, that, and the other. But wicked are never grouped in parties or bodies or churches or anything like that. That's when I say the great and the bomb. If it meant the Roman Catholic Church, it would have said so. Repeated, but it isn't. And abomination shall not reign. Well, anytime the Nephites or the Jaredites or the Jews or we are ready to repent, we can rid ourselves of abomination, as the Lamanites did once, when they got rid of the Gadianton abomination simply by preaching the gospel, and as Ammon did the same way. That can be done. But who today has the slightest intention of repenting? This is what's disturbing now, that people will even intend to repent. Then we're told in the 22nd verse, after 1,000 years of millennial bliss, now here's an interesting thing, we go into this glorious millennium, and after that, then go bad again. Well, why should they? Why on earth would they do a thing like that? It tells us men begin again to deny their God. Well, now, how is such a thing possible after 1,000 years of virtuous behavior? Were not the people of the world put to any serious test or probation during those 1,000 years? That's an interesting thing. Would you say the 1,000 years, the millennium, would be a very tame or boring world, since the sins as we know them, the tremendous vices we're told about here, they're not going to be there in the millennium. Well, what would people do? What kind of test? We're supposed to come down here to be tried and tested. Satan is given that privilege. How can we be tested then? Well, we really have to consider here, there are different tests under different conditions, but we're always testing for the same thing. But by different tests. For example, there are various tests for strength, for endurance, for speed, and things like that.
And there are various tests for intelligence, patience, and honesty, and each culture has its different tests for them. For example, among say the Hopi, They really tested patience and honesty and endurance and strength, but they tested in a totally different way from we do. From what we do.
But they're the same qualities that are being tested in the same way, and that's a very virtuous society.
And the others among the Eskimo have a different test for strength, or among the Bedouins of the desert. In a different environment, so all these qualities are tested differently. Of hospitality, generosity, speed, and endurance, the qualities that everyone prizes. These are the qualities that everybody says are good. There are certain others that everybody says are bad, and they're tested in everybody who comes here. But it's not all the same test. I mean, I'm sure during the 1,000 years, in an ideal situation, all these qualities could be tested just as effectively as they are in an evil setting. That's why you don't have to go out looking for sin in order to experience good and evil, the sweet and the bitter. You don't have to, but you've got plenty of other. But these things are relative. Among our old Norse ancestors, for example, or in the islands of the sea, they have a different test of generosity there. Brother Jeremiah's talking about the spontaneous, overflowing generosity you get from those islanders. Well, it was so with the hospitality of the cottagers of the north, living up in the bleak Scandinavian, Scottish countries and places like that. They were a fabulously, notoriously hospitable people, as were the Bedouins. So don't worry that when the millennium comes, or when things start going well, life is going to become rather dull and insipid, but unless you have a crime show on a TV, that nobody's going to look at that. Because it's got to be crime. Crime is the only thing that's really interesting. When a civilization has reached that state, the only thing they find exciting is the basest kind of crime. They're pretty sick. There's plenty of other excitement in this world. This is, there are other tests. You don't have to go ducking yourself out for these things. No, it's just pretty bad when we have to go that far to find our interest. Just one crime show after another. And always the same base, side, vicious type of crime. It's not nice at all. And so, that was the second bell, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, that's right, we never say. And then after the millennium, the 23rd verse, the end shall come, the earth shall be consumed and pass away, and there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. And you say, well, why did we bother to go through all this? Then it's all going to be wiped out and started off over again. No, it isn't. This is the point. We've heard that before. We are dealing with a pattern of dispensations. Go into that now. For all old things shall pass away. Everything is in process. Everything we see now, everything here, of course, we will do it. All old things shall pass away. It's all in process. And then all things shall become new. Notice this. They're not obliterated and replaced by something else. It's the same things being renewed. And it gets quite specific in the 24th verse. And all things shall become new, heaven and earth, men and beasts, the fowls of the air, the fishes of the sea. Nothing obliterated and replaced. No, the same things become new. This is the Egyptian principle of Keter. You change your form, you're constantly changing form, as we all are, while you preserve your identity. And it tells us that in the next verse, very clearly. After all this change, after an entirely new earth and a new heaven, the old earth shall pass away and the end shall come, it tells us. Then we go into another episode with the same actors. They'll put on different costumes, they'll be operating at a different level, but not one hair, neither mote shall be lost, for it is the workmanship of my hand. There's no thought of obliteration here, and this is a rite of passage. We pass from one state of existence to another. It's a new phase of existence of beings who retain their identity. After all, we've all undergone considerable changes here. Right now, I notice myself undergoing considerable changes, which are deplorable, but they admonish one to be wise and not cling to the things of this world. One is made aware gradually, gently, I would say even kindly, of the fact that one is being phased out or eased out of this particular life. But when the time comes to leave, you don't hang around, you know, just as the time when the time comes to be born. Hell and high water can't stop. You get born like that. After all the preparations, the same thing with conception. The, what they call, the ancients call the rites of passage, take place rapidly. You prepare a certain condition when it's time to go or when it's time to arrive. You arrive, and when it's time to go, you go. And you don't connect right. All of a sudden, you step across the boundary, and that's what we have here. It says it's all going to pass away, it's all going to be different. We've all got to change. We're going to emerge on the other side. It's interesting. It was first suggested, about 3 years ago, a concept, almost playfully, that when you pass through a black hole, you come out on the other side in another state of existence, in another universe. Now, this week, it's been put forth as the most logical and most acceptable explanation of what happens when you pass through a black hole. Black holes are now accepted as realities, but if you get a little glob of matter, which is very tiny, actually, but has so much matter condensed in it, nothing can resist it, even light gets dragged into it and can't escape. Anything that comes near it, and away it goes. But where does it go when it gets into this golf ball, like a fairy? That's it, it pops out on the other side into another universe, another phase of existence.
Light heart.
Yeah, it reverses everything. Well, see, this is, we're being introduced today into this sort of thing of which we have adumbrations here in these sections of the Doctrine and Covenants. The 29th is very good on it. Well, we're only halfway through, but the time is up now. And then, well, the next, it comes after what happens after the millennium. That's a long way off, it says. What interests us is what's going to happen meantime, and then it goes into that in a very interesting way here. So we'll have to break it up now.